Beat down black men and dig. Reach up black men and women and pull all nature's knowledge to you. Turn you around and make a conquest of everything, north and south, east and west. And then when you will have wrought will, you will have merited God's blessings. And as you bow down to the white man today, so will other races bow down to you and call you a race of masters because of the superiority of your minds and your achievements. We must canonize our own saints, create our own martyrs, and elevate the positions of fame and honor. Black men and black women who have made a distinct contribution to our racial history. So Joan of Truth is worthy of a place of sainthood alongside of Joan of Arc. Crispus Attucks and George William Garden are entitled to the halo of martyrdom with no less glory than that of the martyrs of any other race. Africa's produced countless numbers of men and women in war and peace whose luster and bravery outshine that of any other people. Then why not see good and perfection in ourselves? God made man lord of his creation, gave him possession and ownership of the world. And you have been so darn lazy that you have allowed the other fellow to run away with the whole world. And now he's bluffing you and tell you that the world belongs to him and that you have no part in it. I don't have to apologize to anybody for being black. God Almighty knew exactly what he was doing when he made me black. You race of cowards, you race of imbeciles, you race of good for nothings. If you cannot do what other men have done, what other races have done, what other nations have done, then you had better die. Can we do it? We can do it. If any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. Let me say that again. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. They gave leadership to our forebears, and that leadership made them slaves. But we decided to find a leadership of our own to make ourselves free men. Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. Britain under William Pitt, Earl of Chatham did it. America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. Because when the history of my suffering is complete, future generations shall have in their hands a guide by which they shall know the sins of the 20th century. I know, and I know you too believe in time, but we shall wait patiently for 200 years if need be to face our enemies to our own posterity. After my enemies are satisfied, in life or death I shall come back to serve even as I served before. In life I shall be the same, in death I shall be a terror to the foes of African liberty. The need to be the real mark of God I would like to be. If I may come in an earthquake or a cyclone or a plague or pestilence or a God would have me, then be assured that I shall never desert you and make your enemies triumph over you. If I should die in prison in Atlanta, my work shall not only just begin, but I shall live in the physical or the spiritual to see the day of Africa's glory. When I am dead, wrap the mantle of the red, the black, and the green around me. For in the new life I shall rise up with God's grace and blessings to lead the millions up the heights of triumph in the colors that you well know. Look for me in the world when there are storms. Look for me all around you. For I shall come back and bring with me countless millions of black slaves who have died in America, who died in the West Indies, and millions who have died in Africa to aid you in the fight for liberty, freedom, and life. Crazy with its power, and by such to injustice, fraud, and lies have crushed the unfortunate. But if I'm crushed by the system of influence and misdirected power, my cause shall rise again to plague the conscience of the corrupt. But if I'm happy to suffer and even die, but I will write the history for the millions that are coming and leave the posterity to reckon with the host for the deeds of their fathers. Return the laughter to them. If they mimic you, return the compliment with equal force. They have no more right to dishonor, disrespect, and disregard your feeling in manhood than you have been dealing with them. Honor them when they honor you. Disrespect and disregard them when they vilely treat you. Their arrogance is what's skin deep, an assumption that has no foundation in morals or in law.
Who know our spirituality and who know that we exist even through lynching, even through murder, genocide, even through famine, even through AIDS, even through drought, even through anything, even through that the European world has placed in front of us as African, even through slavery. And after 500 years of slavery, we are still here to tell tales. And our ancestors' blood, our genetic memory, keep us intact, even through suffering and drugs, even through pestilence and famine. Our genetic memory is what is keeping us. So all we have to do now is to use that genetic memory that tells us that Africa is great, that Marcus Garvey stood for Africa liberation, Africa redemption, and place all our being in this liberation process. Because when Africa is free, all human beings will be free. And if Africa is not free, no man can truly say that he is free. So the freedom of the entire human race is depending on the liberation and freedom of Africa. Because Africa is the mother of civilization. Africa is the mother of civilization. And if Africa is not free, no man anywhere on earth can truly say that he is free, whether economically, politically, and socially. So if them think that they're going to put AIDS and famine and drought and disease and all these things on Africa and see that they're going to get rid of the African race to rise up themselves, they're making a sad mistake, because history don't show us that. And we learn from history. We learn from the root of the tree that without the root, the tree cannot exist. And if you don't maintain the root, if you don't nurture the root and nourish the root, you could have made the root of no water little more. You could have made the root, you could have chopped the root little more. One little strand of root make the old tree survive. So no matter how you hear about these AIDS and these drought and these pestilence and diseases in Africa, the root still exists, because the people exist all over the earth. So we declare that Marcus Garvey work must continue. We can truly see some semblance of Pan-Africanism in this part of the world. And we give thanks to the Rastafari movement over the years who have maintained Marcus Garvey's spirit in their psyche, who have really go out there and say, look here, there is a man from St. Anne that need to be recognized, named Marcus Mosiah Garvey, and we will not stop declaring this man in this part of the world. No, we will never stop doing that, because we know and we understand what Marcus Garvey stood for over the years, over the century, 113 years of Marcus Garvey. Live forever in the hearts and minds of the Pan-African movement and all black people who seek freedom for the human species. It is all about Marcus Garvey. You know, over the years, people have been crying and begging and saying, why they're not teaching Marcus Garvey in schools? I remember I visited a library, and I was talking in this library, and there was no Marcus Garvey. There was nothing about Marcus Garvey in the library itself. You know, I mean, we see Bustamante picture painted up on the wall and all these things. We see Manly, Norman Manley picture up on the wall. We never really see nothing either, but Marcus Garvey, I don't know no other hero. I don't know no other man unless it's Bob Marley. The two most popular Jamaicans I know is Marcus Garvey and Bob Marley. And Bob Marley was influenced by Marcus Garvey. So we have to give the credit to Marcus Garvey as the most influential Jamaican ever live. But then, when we look at the Ministry of Culture and the Ministers of Information in Jamaica, they seem not to every time you keep saying this thing, you know, I get tired of telling them about why I don't teach Marcus Garvey in school. I think say we who know that this should be done should do it subtly or otherwise. You know, we should take the responsibility to even incorporate in our teachings Marcus Garvey's teachings and not wait on these guys who have no interest of black people in them and to really talk about Marcus Garvey, because Marcus Garvey is obviously a threat to them social order. Marcus Garvey is directly a threat to them social order. So if they start to talk about the philosophy of Marcus Garvey, I don't know what they're afraid of. It is all about Africa, it's all about black people and the struggle that black people go through, and a man who had articulated, and not only articulated it, but helped to motivate 20 million people right around the world towards an African, Pan-Africanist struggle. You know, Marcus Garvey is responsible for the influence of one of the first truly independent prime ministers of Africa, Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah. You know, to this day, the black star is still printed in the flag of Ghana. You know, we don't know why is it that these guys always make the prophet is without honor in his own country. You know, this is one of the heroes that white people still don't heal. Yes, this is one of the heroes, one of the most popular black man that white people don't heal. When they heal Bob Marley, they don't heal Marcus Garvey up to now, you know. That Marcus Garvey is in a class by himself. Marcus Garvey is for black people. Without a doubt, it's for black people. No doubt about that. So whenever I hear them, I say this and I say that and I say this. It is all about Marcus Garvey. I'm going to give you a tip about the women in the Marcus Garvey movement. Recently, we did an interview with Robert Hill. We played it earlier in the year. Talking about Marcus Garvey, and we also last year, this time too, we did do an interview with Tony Martin, you know, talking about, you know, the history of Marcus Garvey. Well, I don't remember if we had played this before, but I don't think so, but this is a very interesting tape. Tony Martin talking about the women in the Marcus Garvey movement. This is the Cutting Edge on IRFM.
Garvey's organization, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, was, of course, the largest Pan-African movement, the largest international mass movement that our people have produced. It is my feeling that our radical movements, you know, as black people, have usually tended to give a greater role to the women than those of perhaps other groups of people, and the UNIA was no exception. Women, it seems to me, were fairly well integrated throughout the length and breadth of the UNIA at all levels of the organization. There was no specific feminist rhetoric in a modern contemporary sense, I do not think. So one has to look more at the practice and deduce what the situation was from the practice. And it seems to me that if one looks at the practice, that the UNIA stands up very well against contemporary organizations and against more recent, you know, organizations in terms of the roles that women played. Garvey himself had some close relations with women in his own family, you know, long before he began the UNIA. He seems to have been particularly close to his mother. He seems to have had some problems with his father, who he considered stern. His mother he described as a saintly woman, too good for the time in which she lived. And as I recall, Mrs. Amy Jakes Garvey, in her biography of her husband, mentions that when Garvey moved to Kingston in his late teenage years, that he sent for his mother, brought her to Kingston with him from St. Anne's, and that she died here in Kingston. Garvey had one sister, Indiana. All his other siblings died, you know, in infancy, I believe. And he seems to have had a reasonably good relationship with his sister as well. His sister apparently helped take him to England, at least help, you know, finance to some extent his trip to England around about 1912. His sister preceded Garvey to England. His sister also lived in the Garvey household for a time in the early 1920s in New York City. So Garvey, one might possibly argue, brought to the UNIA this sort of personal experience of fairly close relations with the two major women in his immediate family circle. But the first member of the UNIA in the summer of 1914, shortly after Garvey had returned from England, the first member of the UNIA apparently was a woman, a very young woman, Amy Ashwood, who in due course would become Amy Ashwood Garvey, the first wife of Marcus Garvey. She was only 17 years old. She has described her own role as that of a co-founder. I guess that one could perhaps consider her a co-founder. She may possibly have been exaggerating somewhat, because she actually met Garvey just a few days before the UNIA was founded. But she certainly was, apparently, the first member of the UNIA. Her mother, interestingly enough, also became involved in the work of the UNIA during that early period here in Kingston. This is between August 1914 and March 1916, when Garvey left to go to the United States of America. Quite a few other women played very active roles in the UNIA in that initial period. I've seen a list of the original executive of the UNIA here in Kingston, and almost half of the members apparently were women. One of them was Garvey's sister, Indiana. She was involved at the very beginning. From the very beginning, the UNIA had a practice of having lady secretaries in each division, as the locals were called, divisions. Later on, there would be lady presidents as well. But even though there were various positions set aside specifically for women, this did not preclude the appointment of women to regular positions at the very highest levels of the party also at the same time. Now, for the first year or two of the UNIA here in Jamaica, the UNIA was very much in the tradition of Caribbean social welfare organizations. In fact, I'm very fascinated by the kinds of activities that the UNIA indulged in here in Jamaica in 1914, 15, and 16. They were in many ways indistinguishable from the types of activities that so many of our social organizations have indulged in. They held concerts, they held fundraising activities, they fed the poor, they visited the hospitals, talked to the sick, they had a treat for the poor of Kingston at Christmas time. They were trying to set up a school, an industrial school. They tried to run a labor bureau, finding jobs for unemployed persons and so on. And occasionally, at the various concerts and so on that they would have on a weekly basis, topics pertaining to women would be discussed. One of the prime activities of the group in this early period was holding debates. To some extent, they were almost a debating society, apart from everything else. And a couple of the early debates were on topics of interest to, you know, to women. For example, one of the earliest debates apparently was on the topic, quote, "Is the intellect of women as highly developed as that of man's?" That was a debate topic. So Marcus Garvey himself participated in that debate, and I'm happy to say that Garvey argued for the affirmative. That is, that the intellect of women was as highly developed as that of men. On another occasion, and again, this is very early here in Kingston, on another occasion, the topic was, quote, "Women or men, whose influence is more felt in the world?" I did not make a note of what was the outcome of this particular debate, but it does show a certain concern for these kinds of questions, even though, as I mentioned earlier, I'm not aware of any specific feminist rhetoric in a modern contemporary sense. Once the UNIA relocated to New York City in 1916 and Garvey had time to settle down, some of the highest positions in the UNIA in the US were actually held by women. The best known of these women is Henrietta Vinton Davis, a woman who had been an associate of Frederick Douglass, the great Afro-American leader many years before, a woman who was an orator, a Shakespearean actor, actress, and who had actually toured Jamaica some years earlier. She might perhaps have had contact with Garvey in Jamaica, I'm not sure. Henrietta Vinton Davis. At various points, and she had a very long career in the ULAE. And at various points, she was a vice president. There was a first vice president, a second vice president, and so on. And she was a vice president on various occasions. For quite a while, she was an international organizer, one of the highest positions within the UNIA. And significantly enough, another woman later held that same post of international organizer, a woman that they referred to as Madame Jimina. Seven of the high-ranking members in other departments of the UNIA were women. For example, in the early 20s, one of the main persons in what Garvey called the Negro Factories Corporation was a woman. The Negro Factories Corporation ran a string of businesses because one of Garvey's main ideas was that of self-reliance. And so he sought to demonstrate that black people could do things for themselves successfully. And so one of the businesses that the UNIA ran in Harlem was a printing press. And a very young woman was actually the head of that printing press. Her name was Lillian Galloway. I'm not sure what her background was. I have seen photographs of her taken around 1922. And judging from the photographs, she couldn't have been more than about 30 years old or so. A very young woman to be holding such a responsible position in this great organization. Garvey had international conventions on an annual basis. For his first convention in 1920, something like 25,000 people turned out at Madison Square Garden in New York City. And sometimes at those conventions, there would be special emphasis placed on the accomplishments of women within the race. There was what Garvey called a woman's day sometimes at the conventions, when artwork or literature and so on produced by women would be on display, and when famous women would make appearances. I was very interested to see that Marian Anderson, the famous contralto singer, Afro-American, sang at Women's Day at one of those UNIA conventions around about 1921, 22 or thereabouts. Many of Garvey's concerns, his ships, his universities, the schools, were often named after famous members of the race. And here again we see one of his ships, Phyllis Wheatley, being named after one of Afro-America's major figures, Phyllis Wheatley, Afro-America's second poet, Afro-America's first woman poet, and I believe the United States of America's second poet, period, white or black. Garvey also came into contact in an intimate way with some fairly well-known women who were not in the UNIA per se. For example, in 1918, as Garvey was still moving around the country, building the infrastructure of the organization, establishing contact with Afro-American leaders, one of the leaders who he came in contact with was Ida Wells Barnett. Ida Wells Barnett is a very important name in Afro-American history for all kinds of reasons. She was a pioneer in the women's club movement among Afro-Americans. She was a pioneer member of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Although she did not remain in it very long, she was disenchanted with it. But she is perhaps best known for being a major figure in a campaign against lynching. Lynching being one of the most heinous crimes that any civilized society has had to deal with, whereby black people in the States were killed in the streets almost on a daily basis. And Ida Wells Barnett, for many years, was a major campaigner in the crusade against lynching. And she actually came to Garvey's Liberty Hall, his meeting place in Harlem, and delivered a speech there in 1918. So he must have had some fairly, reasonably close contact with her. She lived in Chicago, so coming to New York meant a fairly major undertaking on her part in those days when one would have to travel by train. Garvey also came into close contact with Madame C.J. Walker, another major figure in Afro-American history. Madame C.J. Walker was a cosmetologist. She is normally considered to have been Afro-America's first millionaire, at least first female millionaire. And perhaps you might think of her as a somewhat unlikely person, perhaps, to be friendly with Garvey. But the fact is that Madame Walker, despite her riches, never lost her race consciousness. And so she was involved in one or two radical organizations herself. And she didn't think anything of funding organizations for racial uplift. And so Madame Walker was somebody that Garvey admired, and she invited Garvey to a meeting she had in 1919 when she was trying to found an organization a Pan-African type organization, which, among other things, wanted to send black delegates to the peace conference, which was coming up in our Versailles in Paris after the First World War. There was one occasion when Garvey allowed very unusually perhaps, but allowed a white communist woman, Rose Pastor Stokes, to address the UNIA convention. There was a communist cadre within the UNIA who wanted this woman to speak, and Garvey allowed her to speak, even though he did not, you know, fall victim to her entreaties that he become a communist and so on. But he gave her a hearing and then proceeded to explain that she was free to say what she wanted because the UNIA was a democratic organization, but that he wasn't about to surrender his race-first organization, you know, for any communists. The UNIA had a variety of auxiliaries. There were auxiliaries for youth, auxiliaries for women, auxiliaries, you know, for military factions within the party and so on. And one of the most powerful and popular and best known of the auxiliaries was the Black Cross Nurses, an all-women's organization. And on the banner behind there, you can see a lovely graphic depicting Black Cross Nurses on parade. But that's a very, very well-known photograph. I think it was taken during one of Garvey's international conventions. Garvey's international conventions were preceded by a lengthy parade. In 1920, the parade was 10 miles long. One might perhaps expect to have a woman's auxiliary for nurses. That's a traditional female occupation, you might say. More surprising, perhaps, might be the fact, and this, I'm sure, must be indicative of Garvey's attitude to the world question, is the fact that Garvey also had a paramilitary auxiliary for women. There were two paramilitary organizations in Garvey's movement. One was the Universal African Legion, which was male, and the other one was the Universal African Motor Corps, which was female. So here were women obtaining military training, dressed in military uniform. And this has to be highly in advance of anything in Garvey's time or since, because I know of no other major organization, mass movement in the States. Black or white, has had a female paramilitary group. In fact, in recent times, that's one of the things I recall some of the feminists talking about, you know, insisting on being conscripted into the army and what have you. Now, Garvey was a black nationalist. He preached the doctrine of race first, self-reliance, and nationhood. And the woman question was intimately involved in the race first question. Race first meant that black folk would have to put their racial self-interest first. Garvey argued that all races did it, and black people might as well do it too. Garvey told black people, among other things, that they must take down the white pin-ups from their walls. He was against the gross advertisements for skin whiteners and so on that used to adorn the newspapers of that generation. He encouraged, in fact, he himself, through his organization, established a factory for making black dolls so that young black children would not have to deal with the question of our beauty being seen, you know, through the eyes of, you know, white folk all the time. And so Garvey was against intermarriage to a large extent. He was against miscegenation. Now, he wasn't against light-skinned people, as some people have argued. He said that this happened to us during slavery, there's nothing we could do about it now. But he was against continuing this practice, now that slavery was over. And he was particularly upset, as he mentioned in one early article that he wrote, considering the question of, as he put it, rich black men marrying poor white women. He argued, and this was a very early article, but he argued here that in the case of Jamaica, that very often black men were poor, their parents sacrificed, sent them away to study, they became doctors or what have you. They came back to Jamaica, brought a white wife with them, then they died, and the money which they had accumulated through the hard work of the race then went back to the white race when the wife went back to Scotland or Wales or wherever she came from. Garvey actually promoted, you know, he provided an alternative to the white pin-ups that he denounced by having in the Negro World, his newspaper, photographs of a beautiful black woman, so the black folk would have an alternative. I think it's instructive to contrast the situation of black women in Garvey's movement being, you know, exalted in the position of eminence with a similar, well, a different situation that existed, at least as expressed by a famous black woman who was in the Communist Party in the U.S. I'm referring here to Claudia Jones, a famous black woman in the Communist Party in the States in the 1940s and early 50s. And she once wrote an article in Political Affairs, the theoretical journal of the Communist Party of the USA, in which she lamented the position of black women in the Communist Party. She pointed out that white men in the Communist Party, once the revolution was over and the time came to socialize, that white men didn't have a problem because they had the white women in the party to socialize with. She claimed that the white women in the party didn't have a problem because they had the white men in the party to socialize with, and the black men in the party as well. The black men didn't have any problem because when the revolution was over, after a hard day's revolution, when they got back to the party headquarters, they could socialize with the white women. But the black women in the party, she said, they were the ones, you know, who were left out. There was nobody for them to deal with. And that kind of a situation would have been unthinkable in Gandhi's movement. Gandhi himself waxed poetic on more than one occasion on the question of black women. His famous poem on the black woman begins, "Black Queen of Beauty, thou hast given color to the world." And it continues in that fashion. He goes on to say in the poem that time was when the black woman was the queen of nations and so on. When people like Caesar and Antony, he's referring to the Cleopatra story here, and other figures in antiquity, paid deference and so on to the black woman. He says that the race became weak, slavery ensued, and the black woman involuntarily became the mother of the world, as he put it. But he looks forward to the time when the race will again rise, and when the black woman will again be able to enjoy a situation of dignity and respect. This question of the dignity of women was one which was the beginning of the UNIA here in Jamaica in 1914. The following clause appeared in the Constitution, the aims and objects, of the UNIA. Here was one of the aims and objects. Quote, "To rescue the fallen women of the island from the pit of infamy and vice." That was one of the aims and objects of the UNIA at the beginning. And again, this isn't that strange, because other conscious individuals elsewhere in the Caribbean were also addressing that problem at the time. Apparently the problem of prostitution was a fairly widespread problem, at least in the larger towns and cities in the Caribbean. I've seen similar references in the press in Trinidad for around this period. So Gandhi was very much in the tradition of reformers at that time who were upset at the prostitution, the rampant prostitution among black women in this country. When Gandhi returned to Jamaica in the 1920s and early 30s, there was at least one occasion on which he had cause to protest against what he called the ragged and half-naked condition of the female banana carriers on the wharves, the women who loaded bananas. He said that very often tourists, were delighted in taking photographs of these half-naked women as they loaded, the bananas on their ships and so on. And this distressed Gandhi greatly, and he protested against this. Now Gandhi, she did so much. She tried to build a nation. The UNIA was a nation in microcosm, and it addressed itself to every aspect that a nation should. It had its parliament, it had its ambassadors in a very literal sense. It had its paramilitary arm, it had its economic base. It also had its cultural expressions. And so Gandhi, 5 minutes more? Okay, and so Gandhi indulged to a very great extent in the whole question of culture, literary criticism and so on. And I'm not sure why this should be, but many of the poets, particularly of the Gandhi movement, tended to be women. The most prolific poet of all was a woman called Ethel True Dunlap from Chicago, later on from Los Angeles. And the themes which they put forward, both these women and men, very often included subjects dealing with women. The Black is Beautiful theme, for example, was a very common theme. There were themes of the new Negro woman standing up against white oppression and so on. This was a very common theme. One of Afro-America's greatest sculptors, a woman, Augusta Savage, was a member of Gandhi's organization, and she participated in the artistic work. In fact, she did some busts of Gandhi, some bronze busts. And I keep saying that somebody in the attic or the basement in the United States has a bronze bust of Gandhi done by Augusta Savage. And if they find it, they will be into a little nest egg, a little windfall. I have about 2 minutes, but I can't end without saying at least a little something about Gandhi's two wives. Gandhi was so unique, not only in having two wives, not simultaneously, but consecutively. But he was, well, some might say simultaneously, but he was lucky not only in having two wives, but in having two wives who were both some very powerful women in their own rights, you know, even apart from their involvement in Gandhi's organization. Amy Ashford, who he met here in 1914 at the tender age of 17, I've described her as a very precocious person that she was, because at the age of 17, she was a powerful enough speaker to impress Garvey, you know, by her participation in a debate at the East Queen Street Baptist Literary Union one night. And this is what attracted her, apart from her physical beauty, you know, her ability as a public speaker. She accompanied Garvey around Jamaica and later on around the States as well. She was one who was an officer in the Black Star Line, in the Negro Factories Corporation and so on. She was a high officer in every aspect of Garvey's movement. She spoke from the public platforms the way he did. When she broke with Garvey 3 months after the marriage, she continued as a major Pan-African figure. She organized women's movements and race movements in a variety of countries, all over West Africa, in Barbados, in England, all over the place. A powerful woman in her own right. Amy Jakes Garvey, of course, considering whom Rupert and Maureen have written, an amazing woman in her own right. A very powerful speaker. I remember hearing her speak when she was about 76 years old or something at a workers' meeting in Kingston, 1972 or 73, I think it was. An amazing speaker. I wondered what she must have been when she was, you know, like when she was 25 and 30 years old. She too spoke from Garvey's platform. She ran the organization almost single-handedly when Garvey was placed in jail and so on. But before Maureen chops my head off, I want to stop right here. Thank you very much.
When I am dead, wrap the mantle of the red, the black and the green around me, for in the new life I shall rise up with God's grace and blessing. To lead the millions up the heights and the triumph that you will know. Look for me in a world without a palm. Look for me all around you, for with God's grace I shall come back with countless millions of black men and women who are dead in America, those who are dead in the West Indies, and those who are dead in Africa, to aid you in the fight for liberty, freedom, and right. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave. They gave leadership to our foreparents, and that leadership made them slaves. But we have decided to find a leadership of our own to make ourselves free men. Our great scholars have passed through the colleges and universities, have thrown away the blessed record. Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. England under America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. If you cannot do it, if you are not prepared to do it, then you will die. You race of cowards. You race of imbeciles. You race of good for nothing. If you cannot do what other men have done, what other nations have done, what other races have done, then you have better die.
Can we do it? We can do it. We shall do it. We pray to God for vision and for leadership. And He has given us our universal vision. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to America. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to the West Indies. But a vision that said there must be a free and redeemed Africa. Christ the crucified, Christ the despised. We appeal to you for help, for succor, for leadership. When you endeavor to carry your burden at the heights of Calvary, when white men scorned you, when white men scorned you, when white men spat upon you, when white men pierced your side out of which blood and water gushed forth, it was a black man in the name of Simon the Syrian who took your cross and bore it up the heights of Calvary. And now that we are bearing our burden of being so heavy, we just ask that you just help us all up the heights. Oh, yes, the cause is grand, the cause is true. Surely we shall not turn back. Oh, sail on, sail on, sail on, oh, mighty ship of snakes, sail on. Sail on until the flag of the red, the black, and the green is perched upon the hills of South Africa. Because the time has come for the black man to forget his hero worship of other races and to create and emulate heroes of his own.
We must terminate our own sins, create our own matters, and elevate the positions of fame and honor black men and women who have made a distinct contribution to our racial history. Sojourner Truth is worthy of a place of sainthood alongside of Joan of Arc. Christopher Harris and George William Gordon are entitled to the halo of martyrdom with no less glory than the martyrs of any other race. To simply with your brilliancy of a soldier or a statesman outshone that of any other people, hence he's entitled to the highest place as a hero among men. Because Africa's created millions and countless millions of black men and women in war and peace, whose luster and bravery outshone that of any other people. So why not see good and perfection in ourselves? We must inspire our literature and promulgate the doctrine of our own without any apologies to the powers that be. That right is ours and God. Let sentiments and cross opinions go to the winds. We are entitled to our own opinion and are not obligated to abound by the opinions of others. If others laugh at you, return. When I am dead, wrap the mantle of the red, the black and the green around me, for in the new life I shall rise up with God's grace and blessing to lead the millions up the heights and the triumph that you well know. Look for me in a world without a farm. Look for me all around you, for with God's grace I shall come back with countless millions of black men and women who are dead in America, those who are dead in the West Indies, and those who are dead in Africa to aid you in the fight for liberty, freedom, and life. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave you. They gave leadership to our foreparents, and that leadership made them slaves. But we have decided to find a leadership of our own to make ourselves free men. Our great scholars have passed through the colleges and universities, have thrown away the blessed record. Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. England under America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. If you cannot do it, if you are not prepared to do it, then you will die. You race of cowards. You race of imbeciles. You race of good for nothing. If you cannot do it, men have done, what other nations have done, what other races have done, then you have better die. Can we do it? We can do it. We shall do it. We pray to God for vision and for leadership. And he has given us our universal vision. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to America. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to the West Indies. But a vision that said it must be a free and redeemed Africa. Christ the crucified, Christ the despised. We appeal to you for help, for succor, for leadership. When you endeavor to carry your burden at the heights of Calvary, when white men scorned you, when white men scorned you, when white men spat upon you, when white men pierced your side out of a blood of water gushport, it was a black man in the name of Simon the Syrian who took your cross and bore it up the heights of Calvary. And now that we are bearing our burden of being so heavy, we the past that you have helped us all of the heights. Oh, yes, the cause is grand, the cause is glorious. Surely we shall not turn back. Oh, sail on, sail on, sail on, almighty shepherd snake, sail on until the flag of the red, the black, and the green is perched upon the hills of South Africa. Because the time has come for the black man to forget his hero worship of other races and to create and emulate heroes of his own. We must canonize our own saints, create our own matters, and elevate the positions of fame and honor black men and women who have made a distinct contribution to our racial history. Sojourner Truth is worthy of a place of sainthood alongside of Joan of Arc. Christopher Harris and George William Gordon are entitled to the halo of martyrdom with no less glory than the martyrs of any other race. To simply with your brilliancy as a soldier or a statesman outshone that of any other people, hence he's entitled to the highest place as a hero among men. Because Africa's created millions and countless millions of black men and women in war and peace,
whose laughter and bravery outshine that of any other people. So why not see good and perfection in ourselves? We must inspire our literature and promulgate the doctrine of our own without any apologies to the powers that be. That right is ours of God. Let sentiments and cross opinions go to the winds. We are entitled to our own opinion and are not obligated to or bound by the opinions of others. If others laugh at you, return the laughter to them. If they mimic you, return the compliment with equal force. Because they have no more right to dishonor, discredit you in manhood than you have in dealing with them. Honor them when they honor you. Disrespect and disregard them when they violently treat you. Their arrogance is but skin deep, an assumption that has no foundation in morals or in law. They have sprung from the same family tree of obscurity as we have. Their history is as rude and as primitive as ours. Their ancestors were running wild and living in trees of branches like monkeys as ours. They made human sacrifices, ate the flesh of their own dead and wild meat from beasts for centuries, even as they have accused us of doing. Their cannibalism is more prolonged than ours. When we were embracing the banks of the Nile, they were still drinking blood out of the skulls of their conquered dead. After our civilization had reached the noonday of progress, they were still living in holes with bats, rats, and other insects and animals. After we had already unfathomed the mystery of the stars and reduced the heavenly constellations to minute and regular calculus, they were still backwoodsmen living in ignorance and in blatant darkness. The world is indebted to us for the benefits of civilization. They stole our arts and sciences from Africa. Then why should we be ashamed of ourselves? They embody an improvement. To be reflected and resurrected by our generation and our posterity. Why should we be discouraged if somebody laughs at us today? Who should tell what tomorrow will bring forth? Did they not laugh at Christ, Moses, Muhammad? Was there another Carthage, Greece, and Rome? So we see and have changes every day. So pray, work, be steadfast, and be not dismayed. Because as the Jew is held together by his religion, the white race is by the assumption and the unwritten law of superiority, the Mongolian by the precious tie of blood, likewise the black man must unite in one grand racial hierarchy. Our union must know no clime, no nationality, but let us all hold together in every country, in every clime, making a racial empire upon which the sun shall never set. Let no voice but your own speak to you from the depths. Let no influence but your own rouse you in time of peace and time of war. Hear all, but attend only to that which concerns you. Your allegiance shall be to your God, your race, your country. Remember that the Jew in his political and economic origins are always first the Jew. The white man is first the white man under all circumstances, so you can do no less. Be black, buy black, think black, and all else will take care of itself. Let no one inoculate you with evil doctrines to suit his own conveniences. Charity begins at home, so first to thyself be true, and thou canst not then be false, for no matter. Because God and nature first made us what we are. And out of our own creative genius, we make ourselves what we want to be. Follow always that great law. If God and the sky be our limit, and eternity our measurement, there is no height to which you cannot climb without the active intelligence of your own mind. Mind creates, and as much as we desire in nature, we can have through the creation of our own minds. And today, being scientifically the weaker race, you shall treat others only as they treat you. But in your homes and everywhere possible, you must teach the higher development of science to your children. And make sure that we have a race of scientists far excellence. For in religion and science lies our only hope to withstand the evil designs of modern materialism. Never forget your God. Remember that we live, work, and pray for a binding racial hierarchy, whose only natural, spiritual, and political limits shall be God and Africa at home and abroad. With one, the God's dearest blessings, I leave you for a while.
On the morning of August
1920.
Yes, in between the music, this is all about edutainment, you know, yes. I know most people have heard of, I heard speech by Marcus Garvey, but this is his first wife, Amy Ashford Garvey.
This is a souvenir recording in memory of the Honorable Marcus Garvey, the Jamaican hero who pointed the way to African independence in his clarion call for a new day and a new and greater destiny for his people.
Oh. Complex for hundreds of years, that Garvey visibly
and fully determined to preserve himself at all costs. Marcus Garvey, in his finest hour in Liberty Hall, New York, in the 1920s, addressing the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League, said so many things applicable to the conditions of today. Three of the worst history of races written by some writers gives the impression that the black man amounted to nothing in the creation. We are satisfied, however, to know that our race gave the first great civilization to the world. For centuries, our ancestral home was the seat of learning, and here black men who were faithful gods were philosophers, scientists, artists, and men of vision and leadership. On the other hand, our traditions were groping in darkness and continental barbarism. Black men, you are once great, and you will be great again. Great men have come out of Egypt, out of Ethiopia, out of Africa, Sahara. Great men will come out of America, the West Indies, and the islands of the seas. Our history is as great as that of any race or people, and nothing on this side of heaven or hell will make us deny it, notwithstanding the false treaties, editors, speculation, and philosophies. Their arrogance is but skin deep, and an assumption that has no foundation in morals nor law. When we were embracing the sciences on the banks of the Nile, when our civilization had reached the noonday of progress, their ancestors were still running naked and sleeping in holes with bats, rats, and other animals. Garvey's messianic message to the groping millions of his race would surely bring him to Golgotha. His leadership would emancipate millions from the shackles of mental and moral servitude. It was the great gulf. It was the violent contrast between the upper and middle classes and the people of his race, which made the first telling impact on the mind of the youthful Garvey. Illiteracy and grinding poverty were the two decisive factors which contributed to his impact. Like Socrates, God geared himself for his cup of ember, like a Christ on his way to a bloodstained cross. Before his death, however, in 1940, he would have the satisfaction of knowing that a squalid century after the emancipation of 1838, the men and systems against whom he fought such a good fight had lost forever their footing on the ladder of imperial and economic power. Marcus Garvey left you a special message, my children. Let no voice but your own speak to you from the depths. Let no voice but your own rouse you to in time of peace or war. Hear all, but attend only to that which concerns you. Your allegiance shall be to your God, then to your family, race, and country. Remember always that the Jew, in his political and economic urge, is always first to you. I am a man, and I think that nothing that is common to humanity is foreign to me. Garvey endeared himself to his thousands of listeners when he dramatized and immortalized the heroes and heroines of Afro-American history. Through the power of his oratory, Garvey showed them that Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman were equally deserving of a niche in the Hall of Fame as Martha Washington and Betsy Ross. They were made to feel that the muse which inspired Phyllis Wheatley was no less fine than that of Elizabeth Barrett Browning. The black poet Paul Laurence Dunbar was made to take his place with the great poets of the world. It was seen that the African General Hannibal surpassed Napoleon in military genius, and Toussaint Louverture and Antonio Maceo were worthy of comparison with George Washington and Lord Kitchener. Solomon, in his wisdom, towered above Gladstone. King Menelik was more than Abe Lincoln. Never before had the descendants of the slaves been so uplifted. Marcus Garvey delivered that message, and all the world wondered. Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. It was the same message delivered 4,000 years before by the Jewish patriot. Let my people go. Ladies and gentlemen, at the end of his journey, we pause to assess his work and worth. We find that Marcus Garvey has left his people in America at the crossroads of history and destiny. The now 38 independent states in Africa are the first of the fruits of them that's left in the chronology of
and you are listening to Mr. Baruka.
Mr. Garvey, whatever his failings, Marcus Garvey brought fresh hope and courage to his people. Mankind has benefited because Marcus Garvey passed here. And who knows? But someday posterity will confirm him in the title of the Black Moses. Then millions of black men, women, and children will make the pilgrimage to his shrine in Jamaica. For they will have come to pray a kneel at the tomb of the father of African independence. Oh, he vowed to win his race's destiny, to lift them up from ignorance and hell. With deathless courage, passion, victory, fighting on equal fairness, what if he failed? He's gone, tis true. But history yet will tell that Marcus Messiah Garvey did his work, and he did it well.
Yes, that was the voice of it was W's.
So in that sense, all who are divine are part of God in the divine sense. But here is the mystery. The mystery is that you and I are a virgin people. And a virgin is a woman that has not known a man. Any people who have not had an intercourse with God cannot bring up new life from themselves. So the white man, like Mary's father, kept anybody away from us that could impregnate us with a new idea different from the idea of the slave master. He was like a father guarding a daughter that's pretty and don't want nobody to get to his daughter, so he stops them at the border. Who are you coming to see? And if they came from us, he said, don't go among those savages. They will hurt you. Stay away from them. So he's trying to keep us away from our African brothers and sisters and them away from us. Anybody that has knowledge, how many of them come from Africa and the Middle East and try to teach you? Even when Brother Ahmed D. Dad came, he don't come to no black people. With all that he knows, he don't come to impart it to you. The Indians keep him among their own kind and try to get him to talk to white people. they ain't got no respect or love for you. You're a virgin. And every time one of us went away and had a relationship and came back pregnant with a new idea, he saw it immediately. Marcus Garvey went away to England and met with Deuce Muhammad. Notice the name, Muhammad. And got fired up and came back to Jamaica and began his quest for the black man. All of a sudden, he had a new idea. And because he was pregnant with a new idea, we don't want him to make the rest of us pregnant, so we isolated him. But they were not watching. He came up out of Jamaica and slipped into America looking for Booker T. Washington. And when he got the appointment, Booker T., I think, had died. So the Honorable Marcus Garvey began to preach, and when white folks looked around, he had nearly 5 million people under his banner, and they were fighting because that's not their nigga. That's not the nigga that I mean. Listen to me. When you're in the South and an uppity nigga drive in with a fine car in a southern rural town, white folks will come out and say, what you doing here? What you doing here? You can tell me what you said. I'm ignorant. Notice the possessive pronoun. I'm a Negro. But that's all we've been. Is they are niggas. They are niggas and they're black people. They own you, nigga. That's why you wear their name. You get the diamonds, the stones, and walk up. And round trees. And bulletproof. Sadie Hawkins, that's not your name. The white folks' name. Why he give you his name? He own you. And he acts like he own you. Go to work for him, he looks at you. Yes, I think I'll hire you. He don't want your husband. He don't want your brother. He wants you. You get all the skills and you're so dignified. When he starts telling a little dirty joke. And you and all of a sudden his hand is someplace where it ought not to be. And you stop. Mr. Stop that, Mr. Savisky. But you don't want to talk too tough because Mr. Savisky may fire you and you leave that job that your husband is home in the bed waiting for you to bring the money home to him. Damn shame, man. Don't act to me like you're so damn innocent. But you know what is going on. Until we can take our women out from the workplace of white people and provide them their own workplace where they can live in a secure environment and work to build a nation of their own. But that's not their fault, that is our fault. God, time, men, don't want nothing but to shoot a little crap. Play the number. Play the lottery. Chase down a woman, but you don't want to build. You're in a. In a cave. And just like them crackers were on their all fours, you not on your all fours, you hugging the earth like a reptile. You like a snake of the grafted type. And as them white people needed somebody to lift them up, don't you tell me you don't need nobody. With all your degrees, you're not lifted up.
Right.
A degree freak.
Right.
A PhD sippy. Without observation. Just like the book says, see, a Holy Ghost came unto her. A Holy Ghost. Now, you know ghosts don't go around making women pregnant. When last you were made pregnant by a ghost? Talk to me. Anybody in here been pregnant by a ghost? I'll give you $10,000 out of my brother's vest pocket. Ain't no ghost about you. Ain't none got Mary either. You know what the book is talking about? He came without observation, like a thief in the night. He's coming to raise up a people. Wonderful. Oh, praise you, Jesus. Oh, he comes without observation. He slips into North America alone. Look at it now. In the night, the Holy Ghost comes. Ghost is an apparition. You see the outline of a thing that you can't make out what it is.
Right.
And many people saw Master Farah Muhammad, but they didn't know who he was. Didn't know nothing about him. He was an apparition to them. He was a ghost. He was a holy man coming in the night of our ignorance, in the darkness of our ignorance. And the people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. Upon them hath the light shined. But the scripture also says that the light shined in the darkness, but the darkness comprehended it not.
Together those depression years, and and we were all so hopeful. I'm a great teacher, Willoughby Huggins, who allegedly jumped off George Washington Bridge out of frustration. And because we loved him, we didn't believe it. We believed it was foul play. That's not the point I'm driving towards. His point to me, because I came over to his artwork, one of our major unrecognized artists, is what was it all about? What did we do it for? 2 generations of struggle and wishing and fighting to face a generation of young people who don't seem to care, and older people who don't seem to care and don't seem to know. We started the Harlem History Club. We was with an activist called Sufi, who in Chicago was named Reverend Cruikshank, and who really started the buy black and don't buy or you can't work campaign. And we started the whole concept of black studies 2 generations before this young generation started it, thought about it. We were in the river-to-river picket line. We remember days in Harlem community where blacks did not even close 125th Street, 10 cent stores, where blacks couldn't even have jobs or drive buses. New York City, we were on picket lines, not trying to chase and not trying to impregnate every little girl we met. We had dignity and respect and had youth, and now Reed is old and worn and barely got enough strength to go up and down stairs in his own home. And where's it all went? What was it all for? And we're facing a generation who's asking questions about a cop-out generation that's not delivering anything. We never heard of crack. We didn't know what marijuana looked like or smelled like. This is a dialogue between 2 men 50 years later. He came out of the Caribbean, I came out of the South, both poor, committed to the salvation of our own people, both young Garveyites, trying to see what we could do to redeem our own people. Now we're asking, what was it all for? We put it on the line. What kind of work did we do? Scrubbing floors, porters, elevator operators in hotels, taking the insults, surviving however we could. Now, 50 years later, we meet. Here's a farmer. Fine artist, former art director in a major advertising agency. His family grown and gone. His wife's gone. He's had 2. I've had 2. Children gone. Mine's about gone. Thank you. his wife. Bella understood what his life was about, none of mine either. We could have done a whole lot of things with our lives. We could have said yes to the right people. Both of us could have been rich, because that's what we wanted. We could have copped out, walked down Easy Street. We could have been the Cadillac route, the glamour route. We went down the commitment route, trying to favor people. Amen. Now, what has this got to do with the speech? Probably nothing, really. Probably everything and nothing. 50 years is a long time in the life of two people. When you've known a person 50 years and you meet and start a dialogue, say, what was it all about? What did we two people do with our lives? We were committed to our people. We served well. We served honestly. Neither one of us are rich or poor. And it was the irony of it. Both of us have brownstone house. About the same type of brownstone house. About the same plumbing problem. But the main thing, what have we done with these last 50 years? What have we seen? We've seen two generations parade before us. What have they learned? What have they committed to? We started out the active years, the Italian-Ethiopian War. We thought Africa would be liberated by now. We've seen it go to the door of liberation and literally turn around or be turned around. We've seen the two branches of the African world, Afro-American, Caribbean, and Africa, get to the brink of liberation and let itself be turned around. Literally, we've seen God be betrayed.
Yeah.
We've seen him betrayed by his own people. We've seen his dream turned around. And tragically, in his own country, a people who will elect a Seaga, producer Marcus Garvey, and elect a Seaga, a white man from Boston, had problems. Call him a Lebanese if you want to. This is a job artist and a con man who came to Jamaica to be elected. Learn Jamaican folklore. Learn Jamaican dialogue. Study Jamaicanese, studied the politics of Jamaica, studied the folklore, the ways of the Jamaican people, jived his way into the politics, and got elected. No black people. The folk ways, the color ways, the color preferences, and rolled in on their prejudices. Knew that Jamaica was one of the most color stratified islands in the Caribbean. England had made it so. All of this had to do with something. If Marcus Garvey were alive today, ran for election in Jamaica, he would lose. If Mark Garvey were alive today and ran for election and bet the stars up and he would win. Tell you something about the temperament of the Caribbean mentality at home and the Caribbean mentality away from home. A few years ago, Caribbean scholar Keith Henry wrote an article for me when I was editor of Freedom Ways called Tigers Abroad and Meek Moses at Home. I wouldn't publish it. I said it's a good article and it's absolutely honest. But if I publish it, somebody will have my head. But it's honest, it's true. So why don't you publish it? See, it reveals something that none of us are ready to face. This summer, last summer, in Barbados, on an intellectual tour, I delivered a lecture called The Caribbean Mind Away From Home, dealing with the fact that the finest minds that the Caribbeans ever produced never could function in the Caribbean. Marcus Garvey, and that the best minds who attempted to function in the Caribbean were killed in the Caribbean. The last example was the great Walter Rodney, yes. Killed in the Caribbean. And our finest minds functioned outside of the Caribbean, and that Black America became the beneficiary of some of these finest minds, starting with Prince Hall, who built the Black Masons. And there, in Barbados, one evening, before I made the speech, I was speaking to an aristocratic woman, and I said that tomorrow I will speak on the Caribbean mind away from home, and I will start with Prince Hall, and I will end with George Lannan. And she jumped as though I had said something about her mother that was unpleasant. She said, "You dare mention the name of George Lannan on this island?" I said, "He's only the finest liberal figure Barbados has ever produced." She said, "That's how." But if I publish it, somebody will have my head. But it's honest, it's true. So why don't you publish it? See, it reveals something that none of us are ready to face. And this summer, last summer, in Barbados, on an intellectual tour, I delivered a lecture called The Caribbean Mind Away From Home, dealing with the fact that the finest minds that the Caribbeans ever produced never could function in the Caribbean. Marcus Garvey, and that the best minds who attempted to function in the Caribbean were killed in the Caribbean. The last example was the great Walter Rodney,
yes.
Killed in the Caribbean. And our finest minds functioned outside of the Caribbean, and that Black America became the beneficiary of some of these finest minds, starting with Prince Hall, who built the Black Masons. And there, in Barbados, one evening, before I made the speech, I was speaking to an aristocratic woman, and I said that Tomorrow I will speak on the Caribbean mind away from home, and I will start with Prince Hall, and I will end with Joy Hammond. And she jumped as though I had said something about her mother that was unpleasant. She said, "You dare mention the name of George Levin on this island?" I said, "He's only the finest liberal figure Barbados has ever produced." She said, "That's how."
When I am dead, wrap the mantle of the red, the black, and the green around me, for in the new life I shall rise up with God's strength and blessing. To lead the millions up the heights and the triumph that you will know. Look for me in a world when I have calm. Look for me all around you, for with God's grace, I shall come back with countless millions of black men and women who are dead in America, those who are dead in the West Indies, and those who are dead in Africa, to aid you in the fight for liberty, freedom, and life. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave. Any leadership that teaches you to depend upon another race is a leadership that will enslave. They gave leadership to our foreparents, and that leadership made them slaves. But we have decided to find a leadership of our own to make ourselves free men. Our great scholars have advanced through the colleges and universities, have thrown away the blessed record. Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. England under America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. If you cannot do it, if you are not prepared to do it, then you will die. You wreck the cowards. You rest of imbeciles, you rest of good for nothing. If you cannot do what other men have done, what other nations have done, what other races have done, then you have better die.
Can we do it? We can do it. We shall do it. We pray to God for vision and for leadership. And He has given us our universal vision. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to America. A vision that will not limit our possibilities to the West Indies. But a vision that said it must be a free and redeemed Africa. Christ the crucified, Christ the despised. We appeal to you for help, for succor, for leadership. When you endeavor to carry your burden of the heights of Calvary, when white men scorned you, when white men scorned you, when white men spat upon you, when white men pierced your side out of which blood and water gushed forth, it was a black man in the name of Simon the Syrian who took your cross and bore it up the heights of Calvary. And now that we are bearing our burden of being so heavy, we just ask that you just help us all up the heights. Oh, yes, the cause is grand, the cause is true. Surely we shall not turn back. Oh, sail on, sail on, sail on, almighty ship of snakes, sail on until the flag of the red, the black, and the green is perched upon the hills of South Africa. Because the time has come for the black man to forget his hero worship of other races and to create and emulate heroes of his own. We must canonize our own saints, create our own martyrs, and elevate the positions of fame and honor black men and women who have made a distinct contribution to our racial history. Sojourner Truth is worthy of a place of sainthood alongside the Joan of Arc. Christopher Harris and George William Gordon are entitled to the halo of martyrdom with no less glory. To the highest place as a hero among men. Because Africa has created millions and countless millions of black men and women in war and peace, whose luster and bravery outshine that of any other people. So why not see good and perfection in ourselves? We must inspire our literature and promulgate the doctrine of our own without any apologies to the powers that be. That right is ours of God. Let sentiments and cross opinions go to the winds. We are entitled to our own opinion and are not obligated to abound by the opinions of others. If others laugh at you, return the laughter to them. If they mimic you, return the compliment with equal force.
Because they have no more right to dishonor, discredit you in manhood than you have in dealing with them. Honor them when they honor you. Disrespect and disregard them when they violently treat you. Their arrogance is but skin deep. An assumption that has no foundation in morals or in law. They have sprung from the same family fear of obscurity as we have. Their history is as rude in its primitiveness as ours. Their ancestors were running wild and living in trees of branches like monkeys as ours. They made human sacrifices, ate the flesh of their own dead and wild meat from beasts for centuries, even as they have accused us of doing. Their cannibalism is more prolonged than ours. When we were embracing the banks of the Nile, they were still drinking blood out of the skulls of their conquered dead. After our civilization had reached the new near of progress, they were still living in holes with bats, rats, and other insects and animals. After we had already unfathomed the mystery of the stars and reduced the heavenly constellations to minute and regular capsules, there were still backwards men living in ignorance and in blatant darkness. The world is indebted to us for the benefits of civilization. They stole our arts and sciences from Africa. Then why should we be ashamed of ourselves? Their modern improvement to be reflected and resurrected by our generation and our posterity. Why should we be discouraged if somebody laughs at us today? Who should tell what tomorrow will bring forth? Did they not laugh at Christ, Moses, Muhammad? Was there another Carthage, Greece, and Rome? So we see and have changes every day. So pray, work, be steadfast, and be not dismayed. Because as the Jew is held together by his religion, the white race is by the assumption and the unwritten law of superiority, the Mongolian by the precious tie of blood, likewise the black man must unite in one grand racial hierarchy. Our union must know no clime, no nationality. But let us all hold together in every country, in every clime, making a racial empire upon which the sun shall never set. Let no voice but your own speak to you from the depths. Let no influence but your own rouse you in time of peace and time of war. Hear all, but attend only to that which concerns you. Your allegiance shall be to your God, your race, your country. Remember that the Jew in his political and economic origin is always first the Jew. The white man is first the white man under all circumstances, so you can do no less. Be black, buy black, think black, and all else will take care of itself. Let no one inoculate you with evil doctrines to suit his own conveniences. Charity begins at home. So first to thyself be true, and thou canst not then be false, for no matter. Because God and nature first made us what we are. And out of our own creative genius, we make ourselves what we want to be. Follow always that great law. The God in the sky be our limit, and eternity our measurement. There is no height to which you cannot climb without the active intelligence of your own mind. Mind creates. And as much as we desire in nature, we can have through the creation of our own minds. And the day being scientifically the weaker race, you shall treat others only as they treat you. But in your homes and everywhere possible, you must teach the higher development of science to your children. And make sure that we have a race of scientists far excellence. For in religion and science lies our only hope to withstand the evil designs of modern materialism. Never forget your God. Remember that we live, work, and pray for a binding racial hierarchy, whose only natural, spiritual, and political limits shall be God and Africa at home and abroad. With God's dearest blessings, I leave you for a while. One love. Brothers and sisters, Marcus, Mosiah, Harry.
Hello to the president. Africa. I've written the name of the Universal Negro Women Association and African Communities League of the World. You may ask, what organization is that? It is for me to inform you that the Universal Negro Women Association is an organization that seeks to unite into one solid body the 400 million people of the world, with income of 50 million people of the United States of America, with the 20 million people of the West Indies, the 40 million people of South and Central America, with the 280 million people of Africa, for the purpose of securing our industrial, commercial, educational, social, and political conditions. As you are aware, the world in which we live today is divided into separate ways through centuries of singularity. Race and nationality is endeavoring to work out its own destiny to the exclusion of other races and other nationalities. We hear the cry of England for the Englishman, of France for the Frenchman, of Germany for the German, of Ireland for the Irish, of Palestine for the Jews, of Japan for the Japanese, of China for the Chinese. We are the Universal Negro Women Association are raising the cry of Africa for the Africans, those at home and those abroad. There are 400 million Africans in the world who have Negro blood coursing through their veins. And the reason that the time has come to unite these 400 million people for the one common purpose of securing their condition. The great problem of the Negro for the last 500 years has been that of this unity. No one or no organization ever succeeded in uniting the Negro race. But within the last 4 years, the Universal Negro Women Association has worked wonders. It brings together in one phone 4 million organized Negroes who are several parts of the world, including the 14 states of the American Union, former Senior Islands, and the countries of South and Central America and Africa. These 4 million people are working to convert the rest of the 400 nations that are all over the world. And it is for this purpose that we are asking you to join our ranks and to do the best you can to help us to bring about an emancipated race. If anything great work is to be done, it must be done through unity. And it is for that reason that the Universal Negro Women Association calls whatever Negro in the United States to rally to this standard. We want to unite the Negro race in this country. We want every Negro to work for one common object, that of building a nation on its own on the great continent of Africa. And all Negroes all over the world are working for this continent of a government in Africa, which is that it will be realized in another few years. We want the moral and financial support of every Negro to make this vision a possibility. Already, this organization has established a centralized area, West Africa, and is endeavoring to do all possible.
Part in one of the biggest parades in New York's history. As a young boy, to see my father in the parade was one of the greatest things in the world. I would be right there to see him put on his tunic, and I loved to see that sword that he carried. It really made me feel very proud of him. Was one of 100,000 black people marching under the red, black, and green flag of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. The world had never seen anything like it. It was all the work of one man, Marcus Garvey.
Every window that you looked at, people's heads were out to see the Marcus Garvey parade. Most of them wanted to see Marcus Garvey. And he was very well decorated, his hats and the feathers, and but he drove always in his automobile, sitting back.
At the age of 34, Garvey claimed millions of followers worldwide. His controversial goal, to create an independent black nation, made him one of the most powerful people in America and one of the most hated. The federal government targeted him as a threat to national security. Rival black leaders denounced him as a lunatic and a traitor to the race. But Garvey may have been his own worst enemy.
He wasn't one to take advice from others kindly. He made his own decisions, and he would rise or fall by the decisions that he made. Because He was a supreme egotist.
Volatile and secretive, yet charismatic and visionary, Marcus Garvey changed forever the way black Americans looked at themselves and the world.
He started something that became bigger than Garvey himself. He, more than any other figure in the 20th century, symbolizes the turning of the perception of black people into something positive. Professional mason, and among the things that he did was to create tombs for people in the St. Anne's Bay graveyard. He took Garvey with him to the graveyard one day, and they were digging this grave, and his father had Garvey go down inside the grave, but then he pulled the ladder up and left the child in the bottom of the grave. Garvey said that he cried out and his father wouldn't let him get back up out of the grave. He wanted to teach him a lesson.
Alone in the grave, young Marcus Garvey learned that he could rely on no one but himself. It was a lesson he would carry for the rest of his life. Marcus Garvey was born in August of 1887 in St. Anne's Bay, a small town on the northern coast of Jamaica. His father, who had been born a slave, withdrew from the family for days at a time and insisted his wife and two children address him at all times as Mr. Garvey.
My grandfather was a very stubborn man who had to have his way, who he was quite retiring to. He used to, the strange thing about him, he used to have his own little apartment off the main house where they lived. And he would be by himself there, reading a lot. Now, if you look at it, the thing, Marcus Garvey was like that himself, too. He liked to be by himself.
Marcus obviously inherited many of his characteristics. Marcus Garvey's father was repressed in many ways, a frustrated person, a person who could find no way out and seemed to have internalized much of the feeling that the world was against him.
Garvey's mother raised crops and, like many women of her time, cooked for a white family to support her own. But Sarah Jane Richards wanted more for her only surviving son than a life of common labor in the banana fields.
Garvey's mother had tremendous influence upon him, and she had great hopes for him. She wanted, in fact, to call him Moses, and she thought that he was going to do a great thing. That source of love, that someone, his mother in particular, loved him, helped to create that extraordinary self-confidence that Garvey had.
As a boy, Garvey imagined himself delivering speeches to adoring crowds. He spent hours reading, and even let his friends, they couldn't pick a single word from the dictionary that he didn't know.
The young Garvey had ambition. He wanted to get out St. Anne's Bay. Later he said he dreamt of becoming the first gentleman in the world.
And it seemed as if he early on developed this interest in a kind of dramatic, epic story of himself in which he would play a leading part.
But Garvey's grand ambitions were tempered by reality. As children, blacks and whites mixed easily in his community. One of his closest friends was a white neighbor, Joyce Reary. But as they became teenagers, her father put an end to the friendship. At the age of 14, she was sent away to England and told never to speak to him because he was a nigger. And he said that's the first time that he heard and became aware of this idea of being black and what it meant. He felt shut out. He felt that he was excluded and made to feel that he was not good enough. And the rest of his life was really an attempt to prove that he was just as good as anyone else in the world. Under the colonial education system, Garvey was forced to leave school at the age of 14. He became a printer's apprentice and quickly earned the status of master printer. In the print shop, he learned the power of controlling the written word and would soon publish his first newspaper, Garvey's Watchman. In 1910, 23-year-old Marcus Garvey set out on a journey through Central America. Supporting himself as a journalist and laborer, Garvey saw black workers harvesting plantations, loading ships, and building the Panama Canal. They were the power behind the economy, but in their isolation from each other, black people were powerless. In 1914, he came upon the book that would change his life.
Marcus Garvey's reading of Booker T. Washington's Up From Slavery was an eye-opener to him and pointed the way to his conclusion, which remained with him throughout his life, that the situation facing black people was a global one.
I was determined that the black man would not continue to be kicked about, as I had seen in Central America and as I had read of it in America. Where is the black man's government? Where is his king and his kingdom? Where is his president, his country, his men of big affairs? I could not find them. And then I declared, I will help to make them. My brain was afire.
As he sailed for home, Garvey's grand vision for himself and for the world clicked into place. He would unify black people scattered across the globe, and he would be their leader. Back in Kingston, he attended a debate and noticed an attractive 17-year-old named Amy Ashwood. When Ashwood took to the stage and delivered a powerful political speech, Garvey knew he had found a kindred spirit. He approached her later that evening as they rode home on a trolley. At last I have met the star of my destiny, Garvey exclaimed.
Her parents were very opposed to it, particularly her mother, who was trying to keep away from Garvey because Garvey didn't seem to have a solid income or be the type of person that she wanted her daughter dating. But Garvey was a great romantic, and he announced to Ashwood that she was his Josephine.
And she says, if you are my Napoleon, and they make a pledge that they would remain together and forge what would become the Universal Negro Improvement Association, and they launch it together in August of 1914. With the motto, One God, One Aim, One Destiny,
The Universal Negro Improvement Association stressed race pride and sought backers for an industrial training school, modeled on Booker T. Washington's Tuskegee Institute. Garvey and Ashwood attracted a small, loyal following, but there was trouble from the beginning. Garvey created enemies by attacking established leaders. He wouldn't tolerate the slightest dissent from UNIA members, and he was a disastrous money manager, using contributions to the school to pay for his own living expenses. When his few supporters clamored for an accounting, 29-year-old Garvey decided to leave town. He hired himself out on the crew of the SS Talloc, and in the spring of 1916, he left Amy Ashwood behind and set sail alone for New York City. His ideas had failed in Jamaica, but they would find new life in America.
Harlem is a throbbing, bubbling, exciting place. These are fantastic buildings, apartments. The street life is abundant. This is a fast-moving and a very affluent world. And it's a whole new world.
Garvey quickly found lodging with a Jamaican family in Harlem and got a job as a printer.
He was not a wealthy person, far from it. Living in a sort of a hall, you know, a little hall bedroom, the kind of bedroom that was very popular in Harlem in those days. So he was in pretty poor financial shape. But the idea that he had, this great desire to build a great movement, you know, sort of sustained him.
A. Philip Randolph, editor of the influential Messenger magazine, heard about the young agitator from Jamaica and arranged for Garvey to deliver his first formal lecture in the United States. Garvey printed his own handbills, referring to himself as the Honorable Marcus Garvey. He painstakingly rehearsed his speech, just as he had as a boy. But when Garvey rose to address the audience, his confidence shattered. He spoke with a tremor and shook like a leaf.
It seems that Garvey was anxious, he was nervous, he was heckled. He, at one point in his address, lost his balance and fell off the stage, fell into the audience. He literally fell on his face. What he had hoped would be a great sort of coming out turned into this humiliation.
Crushed by the failure of his American debut, Garvey wandered into the Tabernacle Church of Reverend Billy Sunday, a white evangelist who attracted massive crowds to revival meetings.
Billy Sunday was the granddaddy, the man who really created the 20th century revival figure, revivalist preacher figure in the United States. Garvey quickly takes on Billy Sunday's speaking style. Very athletic, very intense, moving a lot, and Garvey would refashion his oratory in keeping with the model of Billy Sunday.
With renewed confidence in his power to move an audience, Garvey set out for a year-long tour of 38 states. His mission was still to raise money for a vocational school in Jamaica. But along the way, Garvey got a first-hand look at the contradiction of race in America, the stunning potential of the most affluent black population in the world, alongside the degradation of Jim Crow and the horrors of lynching.
Along the plank walks. They didn't have sidewalks in New Orleans at that time, but you'd walk along the plank walk But if a white person came along, no matter who it was, a white child, a white man, a white woman, if it came along, you had to get off the plank walk and stand in the mud until they passed.
You was oppressed and depressed and disgusted that you were born in the wrong race of people because of your color? Whatever was left, that's what you got. I wonder what was left. And we were at the lowest ebb at that time. The black people were.
On July 2nd, 1917, just months after America's entry into World War I, the city of East St. Louis exploded in the worst racial rioting the country had ever seen. 39 whites and hundreds of African Americans were killed.
You have black troops going off to fight to make the world safe for democracy in April and in July. You have black people being murdered in the most wanton and barbaric manner in East St. Louis, you know. Children being thrown back into flaming houses. People being boarded up in their houses before they're torched. So even by American standards, East St. Louis was a horror.
And supporter of integration, led a silent march in response to the massacre. But to Garvey, this was no time for silence. It was time for black people to get together and fight back. He spoke out at an emergency meeting in Harlem.
The whole thing, my friends, is a bloody farce. That the police and soldiers did nothing to stem the murder thirst of the mob is conclusive proof of conspiracy on the part of the civil authorities to condone the acts of the white mob against Negroes. White people are taking advantage of black men today because black men all over the world are disunited.
It is that speech that marks the turning point of Garvey away from Jamaica, away from a preoccupation with matters related to the West Indies. And now he's not looking for support for what he is hoping to accomplish in the West Indies, but rather he is now sucked into the vortex of American race relations. Garvey is deeply suspicious of the efforts of white liberals and of their black peers to bring about the integration of blacks in the United States. He, as a matter of fact, doesn't believe it's possible. He does not believe that white people can represent the best interest of black people.
Garvey opened the first American division of the UNIA in September of 1917. Just as he had in Jamaica, Garvey distinguished himself by calling established black leaders weak and self-serving.
Even though I had a great deal of admiration for W.E.B. Du Bois and A. Philip Randolph and other black leaders of the time, I thought that their approach to our problems was too doggone tame, and that we needed to have that attitude of Marcus Garvey, that stand up on your feet and be ready to defend your manhood at all times.
And all of a sudden, this golden voice from the Caribbean came and stood on the corners in Harlem and began to talk about self-esteem, holding up your backbone, you know, no wishbones. And Mr. Garvey gave them hope that there was a dream for black people.
Garvey told black Americans that their history did not begin with slavery. Africa's glorious past was also theirs to claim, he said, and people who had once done great things could do them again. Garvey's message was revolutionary because it, at that time, it told black people that they had to unite. They had to come together as one to and believe in their roots, that they came from something greater than they were told. To begin with, Africa was called the Dark Continent. And the pictures that we got of Africa in those days were cannibals running around in the jungles, putting people in pots. Garvey changed all of that.
I am the equal of any white man. I want you to feel the same way. We have come now to the turning point of the Negro, where we have changed from the old cringing weakling and transformed into full-grown men demanding our portion as men.
He left the impression that the only way there could be a difference in the way black people, people of African descent, could be treated would be for them to have a powerful nation of their own.
Garvey toured the country again, this time initiating UNIA branches in big cities and small towns. Sunday meetings of the UNIA soon attracted thousands. A Garvey meeting was a day-long family affair, half political rally and half religious revival.
The first time I went to a Garvey meeting was a Sunday afternoon in November of 1919. It was the first time I had heard the message of the UNIA.
The day I met Marcus Garvey was one of the most exciting days of my life. It was filled with anticipation from the earliest part of the day, because I knew that I was going with my father to meet Marcus Garvey.
And when Garvey came in the door, everybody stood up in one accord and said, "Speak, Garvey, speak." And it was just like a hush on the room.
He said that the pen is mightier than the sword, but the tongue is mightier than them both put together.
Before addressing the crowd, Garvey would inhale through a perfumed handkerchief to focus his concentration. The man who once shook like a leaf on stage could now hold an audience spellbound.
When he spoke, it was as if you were speaking yourself. It was not like somebody speaking to you, but like he was you, or you was he. And it just was a connecting link, and it was something like fire, like lightning, like something that went through everybody at the same time.
Be as proud of your race today as our fathers were in the days of yore. We have a beautiful history, and we shall create another in the future that will astonish the world. I can advise no better step toward racial salvation than organization among us. We have been harassed, trampled upon, and made little of because of our unfortunate condition of disorganization. Our racial program of today is a united, emancipated, and improved people.
Garvey took black folk who were assaulted by a variety of very unfortunate and negative images of themselves and made them believe in themselves, made them see physical beauty in themselves, made them see the need to interpret and write their own history. In that sense, Garvey sold the Negro to himself.
With 35 cents, a photograph, and a pledge to support Garvey's nation-building program, any person of African descent could join the Universal Negro Improvement Association.
I saw the light. I saw the light move.
Garvey's genius was to transform cooks, maids, and workmen with the pride that comes with a title and a uniform. Always think yourself a perfect being, he wrote, and be satisfied with yourself.
You would almost see them let off into something else. He would see it. The suddenly get very tall. Because the smallest man in the uniform still looked like a giant. I can tell you that from experience. They were gorgeous. The black men were gorgeous.
Jacob Samuel Mills, a master carpenter from St. Kitts, had come to Harlem in 1910. But barred from the all-white carpenters union, he could only find work as a janitor.
My father joined the Garvey movement because he thought it was something for the advancement of black people. And every Sunday afternoon when he was through with his work, he would put his uniform on. He felt very proud when he wore that uniform. He would wear it on the trolley car and let everybody look at him and talk if they wanted to talk. But that was Captain Mills. The effect of the uniform on everyone who saw it was electrifying, but especially on white people. I heard white women faint. When we had the big parades going down Fifth Avenue, they would just fall out.
The UNIA had something for everyone. For men, there was the African Legion. For young people, the Juvenile Division. And in the Black Cross Nurses and the Universal Motor Corps, the Garvey Movement offered black women a place of their own.
We wore this uniform everywhere. That was a difficult statement that these uniforms and plumage made to the rest of the world that we are Garveyites and proud of it.
At one point said that the organization would have been able to develop farther and faster if we had more women in the organization in comparison to some of the wimpy men that we had.
With its elaborate rituals and official songs, Garvey's UNIA was a separate world. Members pledged allegiance to the red, black, and green flag, which Garvey himself designed, as a symbol of a black nation in the making.
Show me the race or the nation without a flag, and I will show you a race of people without any pride. But that was said of us 4 years ago. They can't say it now.
Ethiopia, the land of our fathers, the land where the gods love to be, as storm clouds suddenly gather, all armies come rushing to thee. And then the chorus went something like that. Advance, advance to meet the foe. Let Africa be free. That's women would sing that. The men would reply, advance, women. Advance to victory. Men, advance. Advance to meet the foe. Advance. And everybody, with the might of the red, the black, and the green. Advance with the might of the red, the black and the green. In the summer of 1918, Garvey set out to create a separate economy of black-owned businesses. First, he purchased a half-finished church building for use as UNIA headquarters and christened it Liberty Hall. Relying on the printing skills he'd learned as a boy, Garvey started the Negro World newspaper with a cover price of 5 cents. The paper carried essays, poetry, and articles on black history and world events. On the front page of every issue, was a long editorial penned by Garvey himself. He distributed the paper with the help of Amy Ashwood, who had made her way to New York a year earlier. Then, to attract the dollars that flowed through Black Hand, Garvey created his first of many investment funds.
Garvey was aware that Blacks had contributed to the war effort by purchasing over $220 million worth of Liberty bonds. And this contribution to the war effort indicated that there was some wealth within the Black community in the United States. And his idea was that this Black wealth should be converted into businesses that would benefit Blacks and projects that would benefit Black people.
Garvey's idea of the UNIA was that it would teach success. It was going to be a vehicle to communicate and demonstrate that Black people could be successful. This idea of success was now translated into a whole series of commercial ventures. Laundries, restaurants, newspapers.
Garvey financed UNIA enterprises through the Negro Factories Corporation, which was capitalized with small contributions from his followers. At their peak, UNIA businesses employed as many as 1,000 people in Harlem. But UNIA businesses quickly began to flounder. Garvey hired managers with little or no experience. He shifted funds from one company to cover mounting losses in another. And he insisted that his followers play by his rules. When an early member of the Harlem branch challenged his leadership, Garvey physically assaulted him.
Garvey was very authoritarian and very anti-democratic in the way he ran his organization. His primary concern was in loyalty, not in competence, because he does not attract around him people who are particularly competent, and they therefore would not tell him or try to stop him from using those monies to finance other endeavors in the UNIA.
In October 1919, resentment against Garvey boiled over. A disgruntled investor named George Tyler pushed his way into UNIA headquarters, where Amy Ashwood was now working.
Amy Ashwood didn't really want to let him in. He seemed disturbed. Garvey came forward, said, "What do you want?" Whereupon George Tyler pulled out a gun and began shooting. Amy Ashwood threw her body between the shooter and Garvey to protect her lover. George Tyler said, "I don't want to shoot you," trying to aim around her. She tackled Tyler and they tumbled down the stairs to the first floor. As soon as the shots were fired, the people on the first floor had called the police. The police came, they apprehended Tyler and took him to jail in Harlem. And the news reports were that Garvey had been shot in the head, and it made a huge news splash.
And that moment becomes the turning point, because Garvey survived 3 shots. The next day, he had a big speaking engagement in Philadelphia, and he goes to Philadelphia in spite of the fact that he's been shot. He's bandaged, but he goes and makes his speaking engagement, and he now has this extraordinary sort of quasi-religious significance. He survived. He's invincible.
By the end of 1919, Garvey claimed over 750,000 followers, and the Negro World was the most popular Black newspaper in the United States. But his rising influence would soon make him a target of the federal government and a growing number of Black critics, who called the UNIA a house of cards. The war powers descended on their side to make peace and redivide colonial territories. From the seat of his self-styled empire in Harlem, Marcus Garvey argued that it was time to give Africa back to black people. Some said it was a ridiculous fantasy, but Garvey's slogan, Africa for the African, reverberated around the world as his movement spread through the colonies. In Europe, Garvey began to be seen as a threat.
The United States had worked with the British government during World War I, and they continued that after World War I with a focus on Garvey, because the British government was deathly afraid that the Garvey movement was going to spread revolution. They feared the hundreds of thousands of the masses of blacks under his influence. Undoubtedly, Garvey did stir up nationalism.
I say this plainly and for everybody to hear. We are organizing to drive every pale face out of Africa. Do you know why? Because Africa is mine. Africa is the land of my fathers. We who make up this organization know no turning back. We have pledged ourselves, even unto the last drop of our sacred blood, that Africa must be free.
Garvey's Negro World, now published in Spanish, French, and English, carried news of rebellion around the world. In Africa and the Caribbean, colonial authorities banned the newspaper. But with over 500 divisions of the UNIA in 22 countries, Garvey's message could not be stopped.
The Negro World was being smuggled into Kenya by seamen, black seamen, and then it would be read aloud to groups of people around this reader, plus young children, young boys in particular, who were charged with memorizing Garvey's editorial in the Negro World. So it would read out, and then these young boys would run off, having memorized it, run off to the villages and spread Garvey's word. In that way.
In the United States, black troops returned from World War I with high expectations for change. But they returned to a country that was not ready for equality, a country increasingly suspicious of radical political movements. In this unsettled climate, Garvey's appeal to disgruntled African Americans with military training sounded an alarm.
Attorney General Palmer decided there needed to be a special division of the Justice Department. He called it the General Intelligence Division. And he picked a young Justice Department attorney. He was really unknown at that time, but must have been known enough for his diligence. And his name was J. Edgar Hoover. Garvey really gets pinpointed. Hoover, the Justice Department, were clearly hooked on a fixation on Garvey, which would before long become a vendetta.
J. Edgar Hoover wrote to a colleague, Garvey is a notorious Negro agitator, affectionately referred to by his own race as the Negro Moses. Hoover's agents were in the audience at Carnegie Hall when Garvey bragged that the UNIA would soon be strong enough to exact its own form of justice.
When those crackers lynch a Negro below the Mason-Dixon line, since it is not safe to lynch a white man in any part of America, we shall press the button and lynch him in Africa.
The agent reported that Garvey's address was met with great applause and much excitement. J. Edgar Hoover had long relied on casual informants, but now, in his determination to go after Garvey, Hoover hired the first full-time black agent in the Bureau's history.
He was known by a code number. All his reports were signed 800. That was his code. And his job was to go into Harlem and to infiltrate the Garvey movement, to try and find evidence that could be used to build a legal case for ultimately getting rid of Garvey. Garvey rejected America. They could no more agree to and accept a militant rejection of America by blacks than they could accept a militant demand for full inclusion by blacks.
Just as the government campaign against him escalated, Marcus Garvey unveiled a new business enterprise. It was his most ambitious venture, but would prove to be the most fateful.
The ad comes to Garvey that black people need a shipping line. And he bases his idea on the fact that the Cunard family has the white star line and the Irish have the green star line. And he says, why shouldn't blacks have the black star line? So it is a vision of grandeur.
Black people will routinely Jim Crow on ocean going liners. Black folk paying, say, for first class accommodation often had to travel in first class accommodation. Black people on ships had to eat after the white people had finished eating. So all of these problems Garvey was trying to address through a shipping corporation.
His ships would carry more than passengers. Garvey envisioned commercial trade among black communities around the world, with produce, raw materials, and manufactured goods transported on UNIA vessels.
The Black Star Line was in some ways Garvey's Empire State Building. It was this monument to black commerce, in the same way that the Empire State Building was this citadel of white capitalism. And it represented the ability of black people to seize the day and to have their own economy.
Garvey offered Black Star Line stock for sale in 1919, promising his investors liberation and large profits as they slept.
My parents spent a small fortune in Garvey's shares. They were $5 a piece in those days, which was a lot of money. And my mother had to remind my father that there was food and things to be bought because he was buying shares. And Daddy had those on his dresser. And I remember reaching out to touch them. And Daddy said, touch them and feel the power that the black man will someday know.
Months after his first stock offering, Garvey stunned the world with the purchase of the Black Star Line's first ship.
Let our steamship sail the high seas. Not one, not two, but hundreds of them. The stronger we become upon land and sea, the more will be the respect shown to us, and the greater will be the glory.
The SS Yarmouth, a 33-year-old wartime coal boat that Garvey planned to rename the Frederick Douglass, would set sail with an all-black crew under the command of Joshua Coburn, a black captain. One bright November morning in 1919, Garveyites assembled on the pier at 135th Street in Harlem to witness the launching of the Yarmouth. A spectator said, "We watched people jump up and down, throw up their hats and handkerchiefs, and cheer while the Yarmouth backed from the wharf and slowly glided down the North River. The ship appeared to embark on a spectacular ocean voyage, but because Garvey had not finished paying for it, the Yarmouth went only as far as the 23rd Street Pier. But when the Yarmouth finally made its maiden voyage, it was cause for an international celebration. The president of Cuba threw a banquet in honor of the crew, and members of his cabinet purchased shares in the Black Star Line. In Costa Rica, workers descended on the docks to shower the Yarmouth with fruits and flowers.
It was announced that one of the ships of the Black Star Line would be coming to Panama and going through the canal. As a very small boy at the time, and my brother and I were given packed lunches, sandwiches, and drinks, and were packed off to a place called Christchurch by the Sea, waiting to see this Garvey ship arrive. We got there at about 9-10 in the morning. Midday, no ship. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, no ship, but we were still there waiting. 9 o'clock, no ship. At about 9:30-10, my brother put me on his back and we were on the way home. But the ship never actually came.
There's no denying the fact that Garvey's Black Star steamship line was a wonderful symbol. It was a powerful symbol. But it was nothing more than that, I think, a symbol. The fact that people would come down to the docks waiting for these ships, in some ways, is metaphoric for the wishful thinking that was largely at the heart of the Garvey movement.
Garvey was betrayed by the few people he trusted to get the Black Star Line afloat. The man he asked to inspect the armor turned out to be an informant for J. Edgar Hoover. And his hand-picked captain, Joshua Coburn, convinced Garvey to pay 6 times what the ship was worth, and then took a kickback from the purchase price. Yet Garvey quickly raised and spent $200,000 on 2 more ships.
And making a purchase of those liners without being led by experts, he was deceived about the condition of those ships and overpaid for their own, what their value should have been. It was a disaster for the movement. It turned out to be a disaster for Mr. Garvey.
At the end of 1919, Marcus Garvey married Amy Ashwood, the woman who just months earlier had thrown herself in the line of fire to save his life.
They had a very rocky relationship, a lot of off again, on again, a lot of quarreling. And finally they married in a spectacular Liberty Hall marriage on Christmas Day.
Their extravagant wedding was the talk of Harlem. 5 different ministers performed the ceremony before 3,000 guests. Just 4 months later, the couple separated. Having a wife was an impediment to my work and peace of mind, Garvey would later say. I can't pay her personal attention as the average husband. In fact, I have no time to look after myself.
My father was committed totally to the struggle, and that's why he never seemed to relax. He never seemed to take a day off. He was always committed to the struggle. He was always appeared to be dressed, ready to work. And he's working at home. He was working at the office. He kept tremendous hours. So it was a total commitment to the struggle and the cause.
The UNIA was taking in thousands of dollars a day. But Garvey lived modestly on the 6th floor of a Harlem apartment building. He didn't drink or smoke and preferred to eat the same food night after night. Garvey spent his few idle hours arranging and rearranging a collection of Egyptian vases and African ornaments, making his home into an orderly private world. Unless it was about UNIA business, Garvey rarely spoke to even his closest associates.
I never saw him laugh. I never saw him laugh. At the office, he was serious when we went to visit him there and at home. Well, he was very kind. He was very kind. He was always bringing things for us. But I never saw him. He was always looked serious.
Thousands of UNIA delegates from 25 countries assembled at Liberty Hall and Madison Square Garden. Garvey called it the International Convention of the Negro Peoples of the World. He hopes to move a step closer to his dream of a black nation in Africa, with himself at the helm.
The whole convention is this extraordinary public event of pomp and ceremony and magnificence and grandiloquence. Garvey, he would now establish a stage, a world stage for his movement. And effectively what he gave the black world was a government in exile, a government in waiting.
We have met in this historic building tonight for the purpose of enlightening the world, respecting the attitude of the new Negro. If you believe that the Negro should have a place in the sun, if you believe that Africa should be one vast empire controlled by the Negro, then arise and sing the national anthem of the Universal Negro Improvement Association.
The month-long convention combined substance with overblown symbolism. Garvey installed officials with outlandish titles like Supreme Potentate, Leader of the American Negroes, and Lady Commander of the Supreme Order of the Nile. After insisting that no African was qualified for the post, Garvey named himself Provisional President of Africa. But behind closed doors, convention delegates produced a groundbreaking document.
They developed a program which was based on assessment of what was the black experience up to 1920. And how do we go forward, which led to the development of the Declaration of Rights of the Negro Peoples of the World. They were thinking there needed to be a black Declaration of Rights.
This was an important document that called upon the nations of Europe and America to respect the rights of black people throughout the world. This was the moment at which Garvey, I think, was both the most powerful in the sense of his articulation of ideas of justice along racial lines, and at the same time, his most grandiose and megalomaniacal, because there was really nothing behind any of this.
Garvey's reply to his critics was simple. "I am accused of creating dukes, barons, and knights," he said. "But who gave the white man a monopoly on creating social order?" Garvey's government in exile conducted its own foreign policy, appointing ambassadors and sending a telegram of support to the Irish Republican Army. He dispatched a team of engineers to Liberia to begin construction of a black homeland, and chartered a delegation to the League of Nations to argue for the transfer of African colonies to UNIA rule. When he finally took to the stage, it was Garvey's moment of greatest triumph.
25,000 people, black people, packed Madison Square Garden, and Garvey delivers this magnificent speech in which he tells the Europeans to give Africa a wide berth because we are coming home.
The day after Garvey's speech, a massive UNIA parade stretched through Harlem.
If you didn't live in Harlem, you tried to find someone that lived in a front apartment where you could get in the window and view everything. Everybody seemed to be out there to see the Garvey parade.
To be a part of the Marcus Garvey movement, it made me feel that I owned one half of the world. And I didn't own the other half because I didn't want it.
One Irish woman observing the parade remarked, "And to think, the Negro will get his liberty before the Irish."
And of course we were looking for my father, who would be in the group of officers marching proudly down the avenue with his sword at his side. It was an exciting thing to see.
Marcus Garvey now stood at the head of the largest black movement in history. He claimed millions of followers around the world. But with the Black Star Line hemorrhaging money and his black critics and the U.S. government on the attack, Garvey's fast rising star would soon begin to fall. Not all African Americans were thrilled by the splendor of the Garvey movement. Many were embarrassed by the pompous spectacle of Garvey in cap and gown. A. Philip Randolph, who had introduced him to his first Harlem audience, said Garvey had succeeded in making the Negro the laughingstock of the world.
W.B. Du Bois and A. Philip Randolph saw Garvey as a person who was engaged in a grand distraction. Garvey's emphasis on a program of African redemption, his pretensions to some kind of imperial posture as the provisional president of Africa, they thought of as either charlatanry or just pure buffoonery. Their complaints about him provide a legitimation for the government to move against Garvey. Because you can always say, you see, his own people don't even want him. And if they don't want him, then there must be something wrong.
Encouraged by growing black opposition, the U.S. government stepped up surveillance of Garvey. 8 federal agencies were directed to report on his activities, and J. Edgar Hoover resolved to deal with Garvey once and for all.
They placed spies in the UNIA. They sabotaged Black Star Line. The engines sometimes of the ships were actually damaged by foreign matter being thrown into the fuel and so on. And there was every effort made to destroy the movement. However, that wasn't the only thing that actually destroyed Garvey. There were internal problems to the movement as well as these external forces.
Garvey's own crews took the Black Star Line to the brink of disaster. One captain steered his vessel off course to visit his wife. Another had a nervous breakdown and tried to sink his own ship. Enraged at the chaos on board one ship, Garvey got into a fistfight with the captain and fired half the crew. But when it came to mismanagement, he had only himself to blame.
Garvey looked for people who would be personally loyal to him. I think this is the only way we can explain the mismanagement and incompetence of the Black Star Steamship Line. The first treasurer of that line was a railroad clerk who had no experience in bookkeeping. What was important here, I think, was not an intellectual competence, but a loyalty to this charismatic.
As things spun out of control, Garvey confided in Herbert Boulin, the owner of the Berry and Ross Doll Company. To Garvey, Boulin was one of a few real friends. To J. Edgar Hoover, he was Agent P-138.
He got closer to Garvey than anyone else working for the government. And Garvey really isolated. Things weren't going well with the organization. The Black Star Line was losing money. And so remarkably, he confesses to this informant that he tried suicide, that he was thinking of suicide again. It shows the loneliness Garvey must have had at the top. You know, he couldn't reveal those sorts of things to the key people around him.
By 1921, the Black Star Line was on the verge of bankruptcy. But Garvey mailed brochures to his supporters advertising stock in yet another ship. It would prove to be a major blunder.
In the brochure is a picture of a ship which purports to have been the SS. It was a ship that Garvey was negotiating for and did not own. And it seems that someone etched
into the bow of the ship the words, the SS Phyllis Wheatley. In other words, it was a misrepresentation. It gave the impression that Garvey and the Black Star Line owned this ship, when in fact there was no such ship.
In January 1922, Garvey and three UNIA officers were arrested for federal mail fraud. The man Hoover once called a notorious Negro agitator was finally in his grasp.
The mail fraud was the most convenient and ultimately the only means that they could find to prosecute him. Prosecution was not the end. Deportation was the government's real aim.
In July 1922, while he was out on bail, Garvey made a move that would lead his black critics to question his sanity. He held a meeting with Edward Young Clark, the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
Garvey felt that the Ku Klux Klan represented the invisible government of the United States. That's the real source of power in America, Garvey believed. And Garvey felt that as provisional president of Africa, he was entitled to meet with the counterpart of white American power. And so Garvey didn't feel that he had done anything wrong. In fact, Garvey thought that what he had done was a diplomatic stroke of genius.
After he met with the Klan leaders and had them speak at his rallies, he was viewed as an enemy of black people. For a so-called responsible black spokesman to be having anything to do with these people was viewed as the complete and utter betrayal. This was too much.
In a letter to the Attorney General, eight prominent black critics said the UNIA was composed of the most primitive and ignorant elements, Negro sharks and Negro fanatics. They called for Garvey's deportation, but Garvey fought back. When W.E.B. Du Bois called him the most dangerous enemy of the Negro race, Garvey said Du Bois was a rabid mulatto who needed a horsewhipping. A. Philip Randolph, who had once befriended Garvey, called the UNIA leader a half-wit, low-grade moron.
In the midst of that, A. Philip Randolph received a package in the mail, and thinking it was a bomb, he called the police. They opened it up, and they found that it was the severed human hand of a white man, signed with a note signed by the KKK. Randolph believed that it was really the Garvey movement that had sent it.
Garvey, now frequently accompanied by eight bodyguards, denied involvement and said he was the target of violence. But then Reverend James Eason, once Garvey's hand-picked second in command, and now expected to be a key prosecution witness, was shot and killed. Before he died, Eason identified his assailants as Garveyites. As Garvey's trial began on May 18, 1923, a police bomb squad stood on alert, and UNIA members packed the courtroom. On the first day of the trial, Garvey fired his attorney and announced that he would defend himself.
I think Garvey believed that his powers of rhetoric and oratory would ultimately sway the court in his favor. He would have ruled the court, in other words, by his superior oratorical gifts. And I think Garvey came, in the end, to rue that decision because it was a disaster.
Garvey paced up and down before the jury box as a parade of former UNIA officials took the stand to testify against him. Defiant, Garvey blamed subordinates and evaded responsibility for his errors.
He also took a lot of time badgering witnesses
alienating, I think, in the process. A lot of jurors, by his courtroom manner, he seemed to be intimidating of witnesses, even his own witnesses. It was not a good performance by Garvey.
In his closing statement, Garvey's voice carried clear through the corridors and out to the street.
I want no mercy, only justice, justice, justice. I would not betray my struggling race. If I did, I should be thrown into the nethermost parts of hell.
After a 4-week trial, his 3 co-defendants were acquitted, but Garvey was convicted and given the maximum sentence of 5 years in prison. Hoover's agents had the UNIA under surveillance for years in search of damaging evidence. But in the end, Garvey's conviction hung on using the mails to defraud one man, Benny Dancy, of $25.
He took no advice. He did not heed advice. He felt that anything contrary to his view of things was an attempt to derail him or to deflect him from his goals. He had just an overweening confidence in his own ability in areas where he had no expertise, such as in the case of ships, in the case of trying a legal case, in his investment priorities. He just would not take advice.
In February 1925, after nearly 2 years of appeals, Marcus Garvey was escorted to the Atlanta Federal Penitentiary as prisoner number 19359. His only personal assets were $40 and a few hundred shares of his own worthless stock. UNIA members believed their leader had been railroaded. To dampen their frustration, Garvey wrote a song.
Let no trouble worry you. Keep cool, keep cool.
Garvey's personal secretary, Amy Jakes, had become his second wife in 1922. While he was in prison, she and Garvey's followers struggled to keep the movement alive and raised tens of thousands of dollars for Garvey's defense.
There's one group in rural Louisiana that gave an average 5 cents. They actually gave $8, but when you actually counted the number of people involved, it actually amounted to something like 5 cents each. And it actually showed the level of loyalty that ordinary, the little people, had towards Garvey and the movement.
People around the world began to send in petitions and letters and so on. There were literally millions of signatures that were appended to petitions that were taken to various government agencies in Washington, D.C. In South Africa, people would have Marcus Garvey Sundays and pray for Garvey and so on.
If they put you in a plane, though you should not bear the blame.
But the government had its own reasons for wanting to release Garvey.
Garvey had very weak lungs, and he also suffered from heart disease. He suffered from bronchitis and a series of asthma attacks, was often put in the prison hospital. They feared that he could die or become severely ill, and it would just add to the martyrdom aspect of the Garvey movement and increase his following.
And there was an election year coming up in the U.S., and the Republican administration felt that black folk, who were largely Republicans in those days, might vote for the other party if Garvey was not released.
On November 18th, 1927, after serving 2 years and 9 months, Garvey was pardoned by President Calvin Coolidge, but he was ordered immediately deported. He was put on board the SS Saramaca, a ship owned by United Fruit, the same company on whose Costa Rican plantation he had worked as a young man. It was announced that Garvey would sail back to Jamaica from the port of New Orleans.
It was a Monday morning in November. A cold, drizzly, damp November, New Orleans morning. It was more like a migrant day in New Orleans on that particular day. Going out to see Marcus Garvey on this ship. I imagine the conductors got tired of asking for fares, so some people rode for nothing. And the fare was only 7 cents. And they were just packed on top of each other on the streetcar going out to the riverfront.
And everybody went out with their children, everybody just to get that glimpse of him as the ship would leave. And the people could stand on the levee and stand close to the river. And, you know, they were for 8 miles around by the people.
Mr. Garvey was not allowed to land. He had to stay on board ship. He did not put his foot on land. And he spoke to the people, bidding them farewell and wishing them well and asking them to hold on, keep the fort. As the ship was moving out from the docks, the people on shore were singing the President General's hymn. One God, our frame endeavor, one aim most glorious friend, one destiny forever, God bless our president.
One we saw Raven, we saw him do that with our handkerchief or something. But the people in general, they just was waving and crying and waving.
And the waves appeared to have been in harmony with the song as the people were singing, and the boat was moving out to sea.
They felt they was losing their father. Somebody so close to them are losing themselves. What are we going to do?
And my mother said until the day she died, she would not forget the sight of Garvey waving that white handkerchief as far as she could see the boat.
Back in Jamaica, Garvey received a hero's welcome. He and Amy Jake Scovey settled in Kingston and had two sons. He tried his hand at elective office, real estate, an amusement park, a collection agency, and a newspaper. But when an American court took title to his personal assets and all UNIA property from New York to Kingston, Garvey was forced to declare bankruptcy.
Garvey was no... a person who had come down in the world. And Garvey would be followed by children on the street, and they would heckle him. And Garvey felt very humiliated by this.
Garvey relocated to London in 1935. For a time, he had regular speaking engagements and managed to publish a newspaper. A handful of UNIA members, including Jacob Mills, migrated to Liberia on their own. But without Garvey's strong hand, his hundreds of thousands of followers in the United States dwindled to a small band of the faithful.
The men folk, if they had their names and everything, and you are a member of the UNIA, you'd lose your job. So you had to meet in disguise. That was one of the reasons why the Garvey movement was so thorough in being broke up. You couldn't say UNI member. Marcus Garvey. You whispered it. Marcus Garvey. You could not speak his name.
Garvey was alone in London. The asthma and heart disease that had plagued him in prison began to worsen. Garvey had a stroke in January of 1940, and he becomes incapacitated. George Padmore, who was a columnist for the Chicago Defender, had heard a rumor that Garvey had died, and instead of confirming this, he published a premature obituary. The obituary described Garvey as a man whose followers had deserted him, a man who died broke, alone, and unpopular. When Garvey reads it, he lets out a loud moan and he collapses. He suffers a second stroke. And next morning, he dies.
The date was June 10th, 1940. Marcus Garvey died a forgotten man. But his vision of Africa would influence future generations of what he called the beloved and scattered millions of the Negro race. When Garvey's passionate ideas about black pride and independence finally took hold, he would be revered by many as a prophet and a saint.
In death, I shall be a terror to the foes of Negro liberty. Look for me in the whirlwind or the song of the storm. Look for me all around you.
In his 53 years, Marcus Garvey never set foot in Africa.
I dreamed a dream. As you came, I saw him. An effect of the bonds? Do not be worried. For everything is working according to plan. I am not dead. I am only sleeping.
The organization left the legacy of I am. Simply, I am. With no apology. I am. We had never had that up to that time. We belonged to churches where we sang, but Garvey made you stand tall and quiet, looking into the future. And that's a great legacy.
Mm-hmm.